Welcome to VOA Asia Weekend. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. For the next hour, you will hear many of the stories aired on our VOA Asia program. And remember, you can find out more by checking our website at voanews.com. Ahead of Friday's planned inter-Korean summit, the top South Korean nuclear envoy Tuesday said the next few months will be critical in terms of laying the groundwork for the denuclearization of North Korea. Lee Do-hoon held talks with visiting acting U.S. Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs Susan Thornton. At the White House Monday, presidential spokeswoman Sarah Huckabee Sanders said there will be no easing of the international pressure campaign on Pyongyang until it takes concrete action toward denuclearization.
Certainly, we're not going to make mistakes from previous administrations, and we're not going to take the North Koreans simply at their word. Like I said before, the maximum pressure campaign is going to continue until we see concrete actions taken by, look, we're not naive in this process. We've seen some steps in the right direction, but we have a long way to go. We also have seen a major change in what has taken place in the past by having our allies and partners in the region step up and do much more than they have in the past. China has taken a more active role in putting pressure on North Korea. They can certainly do more. We hope they will and will continue working with us. And that's all at the direction and because of the relationship that the president has built with President Xi of China.
Saturday, the North pledged to halt all nuclear and missile testing and close a nuclear testing facility. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis said there are a lot of reasons for optimism that upcoming talks will be fruitful. Sung-Yoon Lee, the assistant professor in Korean studies at Tufts University, told VOA's Victor Beatty recent North Korean pronouncements on suspending the testing of activities banned and internationally sanctioned are no concessions at all.
So I would argue that Kim Jong-un has given nothing so far. He simply put on a happier face and has already wrested away from the U.S. and South Korea and other powers in the region some major concessions. For example, the willingness on the part of the heads of state of these big countries in the region to meet with Kim Jong-un quite eagerly and therefore legitimate the North Korean dictator as the leader of a not-so-abnormal country, the leader of a nation that is armed with nuclear weapons and gulags. So Kim Jong-un already has won some meaningful concessions.
Defense Secretary Jim Mattis Monday said he saw reason for optimism about the proposed talks with North Korea. Right now, I think there's a lot of reasons for optimism that the negotiations will be fruitful and we'll see. What do you make of those comments?
I think it's not in the best interest of the United States to voice any optimism, even if the U.S. sees something that I certainly don't, for example. Kim Jong-un has been planning for this for months, if not years. It's absurd to presume that Kim Jong-un had a change of heart on New Year's Day, or even that he was so cowed by Trump's threat of fire and fury and total destruction, or even tough sanctions enforcement over the past year that Kim is now putting on a charm offensive. No, it makes sense for Kim to do exactly this, and there are precedents of this sort. His father and his grandfather, after a period of escalation, changing the tunes and willing to be engaged by the outside world and saying strangely reasonable things like, oh, we understand that the presence of U.S. troops in South Korea play a stabilizing role. They should leave eventually, but I won't call for their immediate withdrawal right now. As Kim the First told reporters from the New York Times, the Washington Post, a Harvard scholar in May, June, July, respectively, in 1972, or Kim Jong-il telling the South Korean president in the aftermath of the first ever inter-Korean summit in June 2000 that he will not oppose the long-term stationing of U.S. troops in South Korea or even a united Korea. All this is a ruse, a ploy. Kim, at the right time, will demand, will call for the immediate complete withdrawal of U.S. troops from South Korea, he will demand a peace treaty, which of course would call into question the very raison d'etre of U.S. troops in South Korea and perhaps even in Japan. That time will come, but for now, Kim is creating the illusion of coming across as a reasonable guy who is willing to make some major concessions when, in fact, no concession has been made at all.
Sun Yung Lee called South Korea's decision to suspend cross-border propaganda broadcasts for the first time in over 2 years misplaced and called it needless self-censorship, born of the belief that it will lead to North Korean concessions. There are some predictions that a meeting between the U.S. and North Korean leaders could be fruitful. James Lee, an associate of the Davis Center at Harvard who wrote the book The Partition of Korea After World War II, A Global History, is one who believes progress can be made. I spoke with him.
All I can say is that I see and feel things that are coming from North Korea these days that I have not seen before. So I see there are some positive signs saying that there may be some real changes happening in the country. All of this actually came as a bit of a surprise, and nobody really knows what's going on. But I would say that there have been some signs of some real changes in North Korea happening, you know, rather soon after Kim Jong-un became the leader of the country. My point is that there have been some real changes happening in North Korea for years.
All through the past, there have been promises made, and when somebody came to a negotiating table, the North Koreans stepped back. Number one, do you agree with that? And why do you think there are such changes happening now, or at least possibly happening now?
I do agree that we have to be careful when dealing with a regime like, you know, like North Korea, because the North Koreans have definitely broken agreements in the past. But I would say that you know, what is really driving this this change? I think it's possible that Kim Jong-un wants to improve the economy, or at least he is maybe feeling under pressure to deliver on economic growth, and that has run into some problems lately because of the sanctions imposed on the country for the country's nuclear program. So he may be feeling a pinch, and you know, he wants some kind of a lifting of the sanctions, and that could be the reason why he wants to talk to Trump and to South Koreans. And all I would say is that there's nothing to lose by at least having a meeting with him and hearing from him in person what is going on in his mind and where he sees his relationship with Seoul and Washington, D.C., you know, going from here. Now, you may have heard about what the North Koreans have just said. You know, they had a meeting of the Central Committee of the Workers' Party of North Korea, and they made the statement that they're going to focus all their energy on economic development. So they dropped the focus on nuclear issues. It used to be focused on both the nuclear weapons and economy, but now they have made the announcement that from now on they're going to put all the country's energy on the economy. If what they said in public is true, that is a positive, you know, signal. Whether that means that they're actually willing to completely do away with all their nuclear weapons, that remains to be seen. What they mean by denuclearization, whether they just want to freeze their nuclear weapons, or whether they were actually willing to go back and completely dismantle the nuclear weapons, that remains to be seen.
I do hear a glint of optimism in your assessment here.
Lately, I see some signs coming from North Korea. The country actually wants to be taken, you know, seriously as a member of the international community. You know, it remains to be seen whether North Korea will eventually come to respect the global norms on issues such as human rights. But I think it takes time. I mean, we cannot expect North Korea to suddenly change everything overnight. I would say that it takes dialogue and building trust between North Korea and the global community. As North Korea shows more signs that it is actually willing to abide by the norms of the global community, we need to be patient with them, and we need to and we need to encourage them.
How important do you think the upcoming meeting between North and South Korea might be?
Yes, I would say that it's very important to watch what's going to happen at the summit between South and North Korea. I think that when Kim Jong-un, he crosses the DMZ for his summit along with his wife, when they walk into South Korean soil and shake hands with the South Korean president and his wife, that will go down in history, actually, I feel, as a major turning point in inter-Korean relations, because that is going to be a highly symbolic, moment. And that will send some strong images and some strong tremors into North Korean people's minds, because that will be broadcast on both South Korean and North Korean TV. And I just think, that we may be in for a very surprising ride in the next few months.
James Lee, an associate of the Davis Center at Harvard, who wrote the book The Partition of Korea After World War II, A Global History. We are happy you are with us here on VOA Asia Weekend. Once forbidden under Myanmar's military rule, ethnic minority languages are now permitted to be taught in public government schools since 2012, but mostly with private teachers after regular hours. However, in areas of Kachin State and other regions still controlled by ethnic armed groups, the traditional dialects prevail, with Burmese language included as a second language. Steve Sanford talks to those working in the field that continue to use the local language.
Here in Kachin State's Jiaying IDP Camp School, the traditional Jingpa language is the choice for students who are fiercely proud of their heritage.
Burmese only have their own curriculum in the schools, but they ban us from studying our own language. They only teach us in Burmese language in the class.
For many, preserving the language also means retaining the cultural identity of the Kachin people amidst Myanmar's diverse ethnic mix of more than 100 dialects.
If we don't continue to learn the Jingpa language and the Kachin culture, it will disappear someday. That's why I continue to teach language and traditional culture to the Kachin youth. If they don't learn the language and culture, we'll lose our identity and become Burmans.
Kachin journalist covering the war speaks some Burmese, but reports are delivered in the native tongue to the local population. Because of the travel into government-controlled areas, this reporter wants to remain anonymous to avoid possible discrimination.
My target is to report the news in Jingpa language for the Kachin people who live in the mountains and the elders who don't know Burmese language, so they can listen to the radio in Jingpa language and get information for their awareness.
Many of the IDPs have relatives in the army, but communication is sporadic, so the news is often spread by word of mouth.
I am here at the IDP camp, and I listen on radio news more often because the situation is getting worse, and many of my friends are soldiers in the jungles on the front lines. So I listen to get more news and communicate with my friends all the time so that they get the info and are more alert.
As fighting continues in parts of Kachin State for control over land and resources, many hope to one day also have more control over their identity and culture. Steve Sanford reporting from Kachin State, Myanmar.
In the span of only a few years, printing of tri-dimensional objects has gone from toys to buildings, and 3D printers can now print with any material from plastic and metal to concrete. So printing houses is gaining popularity. The first in Europe is a small office building, 3D printed in Denmark. VOA's George Putich builds the story.
Who says that buildings have to have straight walls? But for a long time, building curved structures required special skills, longer time, and large budgets. With a concrete 3D printer, it's cheap.
It's the same cost to print a wavy wall as it is to print a straight wall. In the traditional construction industry, making something wavy is very expensive. So, and here we can do it for free.
This is not the first printed building. Chinese firms have been doing it for a while, but strict building codes prevented it from happening sooner in Europe. The Danish company 3D Printhuset, the first to do it, says its 3D printing machine may be a dream come true for architects.
We are hoping this will lead to that the architects are allowed, without additional cost, to create some more interesting, some more organic shapes and forms that we have not seen previously.
Initially, the printing was very slow, about 6 meters per minute, so it took about 50 hours to build this house. But Lund Nielsen says their new printer can lay 18 meters of concrete per minute. As for the impact of 3D printing on construction industry jobs, innovators say it depends where you are.
In a country like ours, where we are happy for new technology, the construction workers are reacting very, very positively towards this, and they see themselves having a future.
The first European printed building will be used as a rental office space. George Putich, VOA News.
The U.S. government is conducting an intensive examination of alleged atrocities against Myanmar's Rohingya Muslims, documenting accusations of murder, rape, beatings, and other possible offenses. The report from the Reuters news agency says the information will be analyzed in Washington and documented in a report to be sent to the State Department's leadership in May or early June. It is unclear whether the Trump administration will publicly release the findings or whether they'll be used to justify new sanctions on the Myanmar government or a recommendation for international prosecution. Nearly 700,000 people, mostly Rohingya women and children, have fled violence in neighboring Myanmar since August, bringing the total number of refugees hosted in Bangladesh to approximately 1 million. Earlier this week, at a G7 meeting in Toronto, acting U.S. Secretary of State John Sullivan announced an additional $50 million in humanitarian assistance from the department's Bureau of Population, Refugees, and Migration to support a U.N.-led joint response plan in Bangladesh. This brings the U.S. response to the Rakhine State crisis in Burma and Bangladesh to more than $163 million since August of 2017, and total humanitarian assistance for displaced people in and from Myanmar to more than $255 million since October of 2016. I spoke with Deputy Assistant Secretary Mark Sterella with the U.S. State Department's Bureau of Population, Refugees, and Migration. He said the scope of the problem is immense, especially with the start of the monsoon season in Bangladesh.
I want to say that in terms of the magnitude and speed of this crisis, it's one of the most dramatic forced displacements in decades. And therefore, we think it's absolutely necessary to respond on an urgent basis. In particular, the United Nations has issued a $951 million humanitarian response appeal to address these needs. That's an enormous amount of money. However, we also know that because monsoons are beginning, and those monsoons are expected to drop 2 meters of rain on what is now the largest refugee camp in the world, there is an urgent need for shelter, protection, health care, camp management, and psychosocial assistance for a population that, as you said, is enormous and extremely traumatized.
What happens to the people when the monsoons start? They're not only in Bangladesh, they are on a coastal area in Cox's Bazar that makes them very susceptible to the high winds and rain and everything. As far as you know, what is needed and what can this money go toward as far as helping to alleviate that situation?
This camp, Katapalong, which, as I said, has got 600,000 people in it and is the largest refugee camp in the world, is built on mud. There are almost no trees left there, even no roots left, as those have been pulled out and burned for fuel by people in desperate circumstances. When the rains come, because these camps were established very, very quickly and really in a haphazard way by the refugees themselves, there is a real danger of mudslides and flooding. And with 2 meters of rain coming, those mudslides could absolutely be life-threatening, and there's a great danger of loss of life. So what we hope to do with some of the money that we're providing is to continue engineering work, to shore up the settlements where we can, to build drainage to get the water out of there. But also we're working with the Bangladeshis, who've been incredibly generous, to establish new locations on new land that has been donated by the Bangladesh government so that people who are in the most dangerous location can be relocated someplace where they'll be safe.
What about the repatriation program? The word went out, I believe, a week or two ago that the first family was going back into Myanmar. That did not prove to be the situation. What's the latest you hear, and what can the United States and the rest of the world do about repatriation?
We are glad to see that Myanmar and Bangladesh are talking together about conditions that will permit repatriation of this large group of refugees. However, what's really important for us is to ensure that these refugees not go back, and certainly not be forced to go back, unless they can do so voluntarily, safely, and in a dignified way. That means that we have to keep putting pressure on the Burmese authorities to establish conditions that will provide for that safety, to work with UN partners like UNHCR so that the refugees themselves can be well informed about the conditions, and to ensure that rights will be protected inside Burma on their return so that they can enjoy the dignity that any human being should.
How do you then get the Rohingya refugees who are now in Bangladesh to go back? For the most part, and for the huge majority, from what we hear, they don't want to go back.
We and international organizations like UNHCR and IOM have a lot of experience with this kind of thing. There are opportunities, once steps have been taken, to bring small numbers of refugees on what are called look-and-see visits, so they can test the waters and see what's going on. We also need to ensure access and opportunities for international actors to see the situation on the ground in Burma so that the Bangladesh population of Rohingya don't have to just take someone's word for it, but actually have some confirmation that conditions will permit safe and dignified returns.
Deputy Assistant Secretary Mark Sturella with the U.S. State Department's Bureau of Population, Refugees, and Migration, with us here on VOA Asia.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
We are in the midst of World Immunization Week, set aside by the UN to remind parents with children, even adults, to get immunized against deadly diseases. The World Health Organization, which is hosting the event, is encouraging governments to invest in immunization efforts, urging advocates to make vaccines a priority, and asking people to get themselves and their families vaccinated. VOA's Carol Pearson reports.
Vaccines save millions of lives each year, from the very young to the very old. Doctors the world over want people to know that vaccines work. Dr. Flavia Bustreo worked for years at the World Health Organization and for Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance.
Immunization and vaccines are the most powerful public health tool that we have.
The World Health Organization says over the last 35 years, 13 million children have lost their lives to diseases, lives that could have been saved if these children had received the right vaccine. Vaccines exist for many deadly diseases and can protect children from whooping cough, measles, polio, and more. The WHO aims to vaccinate as many as 1 billion people from 27 high-risk African countries by the year 2026 against yellow fever, a mosquito-borne disease that can be fatal. Dr. Ken Redcross explained why yellow fever is so deadly on Africa 54, a program on the Voice of America.
It's fatal because it can cause liver failure, it can cause kidney failure, it can even cause what's called a coagulopathy, which is a long word to mean that it causes a problem with our blood clotting.
In Brazil, efforts to vaccinate up to 24 million people against the disease have fallen short because some fear the vaccine is unsafe. Officials have been trying to counter the misinformation. Dr. Redcross says not only is the vaccine safe, it's also highly effective.
It confers 90% immunity, and that's huge as a vaccine goes.
Today, 85% of children are vaccinated against measles and other deadly diseases. But Dr. Bustreo says that's not good enough.
We need in a population to have a vaccination coverage that is above 90% in order to have what we call the herd effect, the herd immunity, which means that you cover the children that are vaccinated, but also because of the reduction of transmission of the infections, you also cover the children that are not vaccinated.
The WHO is urging countries to strengthen their routine immunizations. Among its goals by the year 2020, to complete international efforts to end polio, which now exists in only 3 countries, thanks to a highly effective vaccine. The WHO also wants to control more vaccine-preventable diseases and develop new vaccines for HIV and other diseases that still plague the modern world. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
We are happy you are with us here on VOA Asia Weekend. President Donald Trump said he will have a full agenda and propose talks with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in coming weeks, following meetings with Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe earlier this month at the Mar-a-Lago Resort in Florida. Mr. Trump said he hoped for a successful outcome to such a meeting.
Hopefully that meeting will be a great success, and we're looking forward to it. It would be a tremendous thing for North Korea and a tremendous thing for the world. So we will be doing everything possible to make it a worldwide success.
Mr. Trump said the trip to North Korea by the Director of Central Intelligence, Mike Pompeo, formed a good relationship with Mr. Kim. He also said denuclearization in a complete, verifiable, and irreversible way would lead to a bright path for North Korea. However, he said he is also prepared to walk away from such a meeting should success remain elusive. The president said among the items on his agenda for such talks would be the fate of Japanese abducted by the North Korean regime, 3 Americans still detained in North Korea, and according to U.S.-Japan Ambassador Bill Hagerty, eliminating the North's arsenal of chemical and biological weapons. As for the Trump-Kim meeting, the RAND Corporation's Jeffrey Hornung told VOA's Victor Beatty the Pompeo visit to North Korea appears to confirm a meeting will actually take place. But does he detect a change in North Korean behavior? Hornung is skeptical.
The one thing that people need to keep in mind always is that what denuclearization means differs. So the U.S. and even Japan tend to look at denuclearization as complete, verifiable denuclearization, whereas North Korea looks at denuclearization from the standpoint of all nukes gone from the peninsula. This includes the U.S. nuclear umbrella. And so I think when you have negotiators sit down and when you do have the summit actually occur, they might come to the realization that their definitions of denuclearization differ.
President also indicated that negotiations are underway for the release of 3 Americans held as prisoners in North Korea. This is something that really has been under the radar and hasn't been talked much about.
If you look at what success could mean for a summit, you're going to probably look for some broad announcements, but also something that is specific, that would be tangible evidence that maybe some success has been made by both sides. And so something like the release of prisoners would be that low-hanging, tangible evidence that maybe the North Korean regime wants to show to the U.S. that's serious about talking.
And an issue that's very close to Mr. Abe, Japanese abducted by North Koreans. Mr. Trump said that's on the table as well.
Obviously, from the Japanese standpoint, they have 3 priorities for Mr. Trump. They're the same with the U.S. in terms of denuclearization and the ballistic missile program, basically scaling that down or abolishing that. But the third is Mr. Abe has made really a career out of trying to pursue the abductees that North Koreans have taken from Japan since the 70s and 80s. And he came here with a goal of making sure that Trump knew about this and that put it on the agenda. But I think there's still some skittishness within Tokyo about whether or not, if it comes down to a hard negotiation with denuclearization versus abductees, there's still skittishness on whether the U.S. would fulfill that.
The president brought up the issue of trade deficits with Japan. How big a deal is trade in Japan? Can this be resolved?
trade is a big deal, but it's a big deal in the sense that Mr. Abe has worked for free trade, and he's really put a lot of investment into the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the multilateral trade agreement. Mr. Abe knows very well the U.S. complaints about the trade deficit, and he also knows very well that Mr. Trump would like a bilateral free trade agreement with Japan. They have not really shown any intention to work towards a bilateral free trade agreement, given how much energy Japan has put into the TPP.
VOA Asia Weekend continues. Authorities in Pakistan have begun negotiations with traders from the country's tribal areas bordering Afghanistan regarding damages caused during a military operation. VOA's Aisha Tanzim reported the North Waziristan tribal agency had become a hub of militancy before Pakistan's military cleared out the area through an operation that began in 2014.
Syed Amir was a successful businessman 4 years ago, with a monthly turnover reaching over $100,000. Now, he owes others more than $150,000. He is one of thousands of traders who had to leave their shops and businesses in North Waziristan at 3 days' notice in 2014. That is when the military launched an operation against militants in Pakistan's tribal areas bordering Afghanistan. When the area was cleared and the traders went back in 2016, everything they had left behind was gone.
When we got there, all the shops were gone. It was just level ground. I could not see the mosque or the shops. All I could see was the road and ground.
Their requests for reparations went unheeded till this week, when they sent several hundred representatives to protest in capital Islamabad. Pakistan's authorities say since militants were also using some of the shops, they were damaged during the fighting and had to be demolished. Military spokesman Major General Asif Ghafoor said rehabilitation of the local population is a high priority, and everyone who lost a shop in North Waziristan would be provided a replacement. While VOA interviewed him on camera, we could not use it since his team refused to give us an uncut version of the interview that was shot on their cameras. Meanwhile, the traders seem hopeful about the assurances given to them by the authorities. They are scheduled to meet with civilian and military representatives on Sunday to chart the way forward. Aisha Tanzim, VOA News, Islamabad.
The United Nations Refugee Agency and Bangladesh have signed a memorandum of understanding laying out a framework for the voluntary repatriation of Rohingya refugees to Myanmar. The agreement is aimed at establishing cooperation between the UN agency and Bangladesh on the safe, voluntary, and dignified returns of refugees in line with international standards, if and when the conditions are conducive to returns. This development comes amid a story of a family Myanmar says had returned home only to be disputed by Bangladesh as a publicity stunt. I spoke with UNHCR spokesperson Andre Mahechik about this family and the larger Rohingya repatriation status.
I think it's important to understand that this in this particular story, neither UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency, nor the government of Bangladesh was actually involved in this return of a reportedly Rohingya family. We have had no direct knowledge of this case. We were not consulted or involved in this reported return movement. And our understanding is that the government of Bangladesh was also not involved. On this particular family, we have no further information also on the circumstances of this movement. Now, this reported return obviously did not take place under the terms of the agreement on voluntary repatriation, which the government of Bangladesh and UNHCR recently signed. There was a memorandum of understanding signed on the 13th of April. Also, this movement was conducted outside the ongoing discussions on a tripartite agreement between the government of Myanmar, the United Nations Development Program, and UNHCR. And that particular tripartite agreement is aiming to set forth a framework for the voluntary repatriation, which would be in line with international standards to create conditions that are conducive to eventual voluntary, safe, dignified, and sustainable returns, and also to provide humanitarian and development assistance for all residents of Rakhine State without discrimination. Now, we have been urging the government of Myanmar to ensure that any returns are voluntary, safe, and dignified, and that the people can sustainably reintegrate into the community, because people should be allowed to return to their places of origin or other locations of their choice. And any returnee to Myanmar should not be required to stay in transit centers for more than a few days before being allowed to travel to their chosen destination. I mean, ultimately, what has been our consistent position is that the conditions for the returns in Myanmar, we consider that those conditions are not yet conducive for returns to be safe and dignified and sustainable. And the responsibility for creating such conditions, these remain with Myanmar authorities. And these must go beyond just preparing a physical infrastructure or facilitate logistical arrangement.
Why would Myanmar want to take part in something that would create a situation that they don't want?
I cannot speculate about the intentions of the Myanmar authorities, but for us it is critical that the returns are not rushed or premature, that the timing and pace of repatriation should be determined by the refugees themselves when they feel the circumstances are right and when there is also absorption capacity on the ground. I mean, the key point here goes back to the situation in Myanmar. Where the conditions need to be put in place. And refugees in Bangladesh have said to us and others that essentially before considering return to Myanmar, they would need to see concrete progress in relation to their legal status and citizenship, security, their ability to enjoy their basic rights at home in Rakhine State. And in that regard, we have been continually calling on the government of Myanmar to take concrete measures to address the root causes of the displacement, very much in line with the recommendations of the Advisory Commission on Rakhine State, to which Myanmar actually publicly committed itself both in August last year, just prior to the outbreak of violence, and again on the 23rd of November when they signed a bilateral agreement with Bangladesh on voluntary repatriation of Rohingya refugees.
What is Bangladesh's position on all of this?
I cannot talk on behalf of the Bangladeshi government, but the memorandum of understanding that we have signed and the bilateral that they have signed in November last year with Myanmar clearly state that set out the need to respect the international standards in refugee returns, and that very much relates to the voluntariness of the return, the safety of the returns, and the dignity of the returns. Now, in the absence of a tripartite agreement, which traditionally we would have in any refugee situation between the country of origin, the country of asylum, and UNHCR, that has not happened. So we have continued to engage both governments in talks on two separate memorandum of understanding, which are meant to ensure that these returns are conducted in line with international standards. We have concluded our discussions with Bangladesh at the end of last week and signed an agreement with them. The crux of this is getting the conditions in Myanmar right. And one step that the government of Myanmar could immediately take is not just the implementation of the recommendations of the Rakhine Advisory Commission, but also provide UNHCR and other relevant actors with full and unhindered access to northern Rakhine.
UNHCR spokesperson Andrei Mihajcik: some 700,000 Rohingya Muslims have fled a military crackdown and crossed into Bangladesh from Myanmar's Rakhine State since August of 2017. The Northern Territory government in Australia says it's been approached by nearly 50 Chinese companies looking to buy land to start donkey farms. Demand for donkey products, especially donkey hide gelatin, is increasing in China while global supplies fall. From Sydney, Phil Mercer had the story.
The Northern Territory government has bought a small herd of wild donkeys for its research station near the outback town of Katherine. Earlier this month, a delegation of Chinese business people visited the facility, and up to 50 companies from China have expressed interest in buying land to set up donkey farms. It's estimated there are up to 60,000 wild donkeys in the Northern Territory. Donkeys were brought to Australia from Africa as pack animals in the 1860s, and many were released when they were no longer needed. For years, feral donkeys have been considered a major pest by farmers. The animals trample native vegetation, spread weeds, and compete with domestic cattle for food and water. Now the authorities believe there are economic benefits in captive donkey herds. Alistair Trier, the head of the Northern Territory's Department of Primary Industry, believes the donkey trade has a bright future.
My feel is that the industry will develop, but it won't displace the cattle industry, for example. I just don't think that'll happen. But what it will do is add some diversification opportunities for the use of pastoral land and Aboriginal land in the Northern Territory.
In China, donkey skins are boiled down to make gelatin, which is then used in alternative Chinese medicines and cosmetics. Animal rights campaigners are pressuring the authorities not to allow the live export of donkeys to China, claiming that conditions in transit would be cruel and unacceptable. Activists also insist that donkeys' health suffers when they're kept in large herds. The Royal Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals in Australia wants the donkey skin trade stopped altogether because of concerns the animals are being skinned alive overseas and treated with extreme cruelty. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Earth Day was marked on April 22nd and is marked on April 22nd every year. And the theme for 2018 was plastics pollution. The food industry uses plastic to wrap its products in many places around the world. Plastics manufacturers say that keeps produce and meat fresh longer, so less goes bad and gets thrown away. However, according to a new European study, while the annual use of plastic packaging has grown since the 1950s, so has food waste. VOA's Faiza El-Masri has the story. Faith Lapidus narrates.
On supermarket shelves around the world, fresh food products are wrapped in plastic. The packaging makes food look fresh and long-lasting. But a new study from Friends of the Earth Europe and Zero Waste Europe says plastic does not actually keep food fresh longer, and so does not help reduce food waste. In fact, it can actually increase waste because customers may end up buying more than they need.
What this study shows is that between 2004 and 2014, we've seen a 40 to 50% increase in plastic packaging, and we've seen a doubling in food waste. And what that really casts into quite serious doubt, I think, is the argument that the food packaging industry use very often, which is that we need plastic to avoid food waste.
By the end of the study in 2014, annual household food waste amounted to around 30 million tons, with the average person tossing out more than 173 kilograms of food a year. To reduce waste, some stores have been urging customers to change the way they take their food home and store it. In North London, Planet Organic has opened a bulk food section called Unpackaged, where people can fill up their own reusable containers.
We set up the first zero waste shop in 2006, and we've definitely seen a growing trend towards shopping without packaging. But it's certainly been within the last 3 or 4 months since all of the campaigns about plastics in the ocean has really fired up the public imagination. And we've got a 40% upturn in sales since Christmas. So the public's really on board with it now.
But the British Plastics Federation says there's still a role for its product.
No one has more of a problem with plastics waste than the British plastics industry. I think we absolutely welcome this report and its findings. We'll look at it into detail and we'll take it away and we'll see what lessons there are to be learned. If you look around you, your plastics packaging, I think we can all agree it ultimately makes food fresher, it's more hygienic and it's healthier.
The study acknowledges that plastic has a role to play in food packaging, but adds that as we've become more aware of the damage plastic does to our planet, it's time for the industry to find alternatives. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Recently, the world was stunned to learn that an island of mostly plastic trash floating in the Pacific Ocean grew to the size of France, Germany, and Spain combined. As plastics take centuries to decompose, scientists at Britain's University of Portsmouth have been working to solve the problem. Now VOA's George Putich has learned they may have found a way to speed up plastic decomposition.
This complicated machinery may hold the world's best hope for solving the problem that is slowly choking our planet, plastic waste. At the Diamond Light Source facility in Oxfordshire, scientists from the University of Portsmouth and other scientific institutions were trying to analyze the chemistry of an enzyme that helps a certain bacteria decompose the most common plastic known by its acronym PET. Using beams of incredibly powerful light, they changed the enzyme's structure and then reinserted it into the bacteria to see what will happen.
We actually thought we were making the enzyme slower by changing a few amino acids, but actually we've made it faster. We've made an improved version of the enzyme, better than the natural one already.
Under the microscope, scientists could see the bacteria eating plastics more quickly. The process is similar to the development of laundry detergents in the 1950s, whose enzymes were made more stable, enabling them to decompose proteins in fat and dirt much faster. But speeding up decomposition of PET proved to be a much tougher task.
And now we can actually digest PET within days much quicker than in the environment. And the idea here is that we can make the enzyme faster now by understanding how it works, and then we have an industrial process.
For now, scientists say they can generate only grams of the new enzyme. In partnership with industry, they hope they will be able to produce kilograms. They also hope that further experiments will lead to even faster working plastics eating enzyme. George Putich, VOA News.
South Korea Monday halted cross-border propaganda broadcasts the defense ministry said was aimed at reducing military tensions and creating the mood for peaceful talks. This will be the first inter-Korean summit in more than a decade. As preparations were underway, President Donald Trump Sunday cautioned we're a long way from conclusion on North Korea on denuclearization. Earlier, Mr. Trump welcomed the North's decision to halt nuclear and missile testing and scrapping its nuclear test site. Appearing Sunday on the NBC program Meet the Press with Chuck Todd, White House Legislative Affairs Director Mark Short emphasized cautious optimism.
You've heard the president say many times, we're going to keep up maximum pressure. We're not going to stop that until they denuclearize. So as far as having a meeting, he's also said I can walk away from the table. But Chuck, it's all the more important reason as to why we need to get a Secretary of State confirmed sooner rather than later, because these are important issues pressing before the American people.
But if, I guess, denuclearization, what does that mean to the president, and what do you think that means to the North Koreans? Do you think you guys agree on what that word even means?
I think there has to have a sit-down conversation to get to that point, but I think that from our perspective, it means full denuclearization, no longer having nuclear weapons that can be used in warfare against any of our allies.
On a separate program Sunday, CBS Face the Nation, the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Bob Corker, expressed skepticism about the North's intentions, insisting Kim Jong-un sees deliverable nuclear weapons as his ticket to keep his regime in place. Corker said the idea he'll be charmed out of his nuclear program is unrealistic. Harry Kasianis, the director of defense studies at the Center for the National Interest, told VOA's Victor Beatty the world has been down the path of past North Korean broken promises.
The thing that we have to understand is why would the North Koreans give up their nuclear weapons? It's the only ace card that they have to stop the United States or South Korea or even Japan from imposing regime change or, you know, attacking them militarily. So in order for North Korea to even consider giving up its nuclear weapons,
what would we be able to offer them? What would China be able to offer them? We could be talking hundreds of billions of dollars, economic incentives. What they'd ask for is astronomical. And there's one thing that we have to really consider here. The North Koreans have not committed to denuclearization. They've committed to talking about it, but they've committed to talking about denuclearization countless times. So I think it's important to sort of take all these statements with a grain of salt, whether it's offering to close their nuclear facilities, which, to be honest with you, are just tunnels that they could just start using again, or testing missiles. They can start testing missiles at any time. And the missiles that they've actually offered to stop testing are long-range missiles. They haven't talked about short-range, medium-range, intermediate-range. So this whole thing is filled with a lot of holes then. We're going to have to see how it plays out.
An analyst said that North Korea has a long history of raising the issue of denuclearization, has committed to freeze its nuclear weapon programs in the past. We all remember how those pledges and commitments went down over the past decades.
The North Koreans have a history of making big, bold promises and then not delivering them. And the thing is, too, is even if North Korea does have a summit with South Korea, which is going to happen on Friday, or they have a summit sometime in either late May or June with President Trump, even if they do declare that they are willing to fully give up all of their nuclear weapons, the devil's in the details. So, for example, would the North Koreans allow fully intrusive inspections, meaning, you know, hundreds, maybe even 1,000 or more inspectors would be able to go all through North Korea and go anywhere? And that means Kim Jong-un's palaces, military bases, installations, scientific facilities. They would have to be able to go anywhere to not only document the size and scale of North Korea's nuclear program, but actually get a full accounting of how many bombs or missiles he has. Would the North Koreans allow that? Does that mean that the North Koreans would allow that all of their, you know, atomic facilities, you know, power plants, nuclear reactors, would all that be able to be, you know, scaled down and packaged and sent out of the country? These are all the questions that have to be answered. And to be quite frank, they need to be answered before there's a summit with President Trump. Because my fear is we're going to go down this whole peace path where everybody's expectations are going to get super, super high. And then when we come to the end of the road, when the North Koreans say, well, I'm not going to allow inspectors in. You're just going to have to trust us. So I think we really need to test North Korea's intentions before we get to the bargaining table.
In an editorial, China's state-run Global Times called on the United States, South Korea, and Japan to cherish the North's promise to halt its testing, calling it a hard-won state of affairs. It said the goal of denuclearization should be achievable. It called on the international community to encourage Pyongyang by lifting some sanctions and resuming certain exchanges. Coming up on VOA Asia Weekend, schools come to modern-day cave dwellers. Several thousand people attended a rally in Pakistan's second-largest city, Lahore, last weekend to demand justice for the country's ethnic Pashtun population, that despite an initial crackdown by local authorities. The rally was one in a series planned to demand an end to extrajudicial killings and the return of victims of enforced disappearances. VOA's Aisha Tanzim was at the rally and shared more on the story.
Men and women raised their hands and sang along enthusiastically on a revolutionary poem originally written against a military dictator in the 60s. The protest was peaceful, despite earlier arrests and later release of some of the protest leaders. A day before, local authorities had released sewage water in this ground, which volunteers cleared themselves. Many who gathered here had come from as far off as Pakistan's tribal areas bordering Afghanistan. One old man explained why he made such a long trek.
I have feelings too. I have spent time in a human society. Human beings are dying, getting killed, and no one is saying anything.
Various human rights groups and civil society organizations joined the protest, including the Human Rights Commission of Pakistan.
I think the first thing that's important for us is that this is a movement that symbolizes the struggle of the common Pakistani people for human rights, for the rights of people to their life, to their liberty, and to their dignity.
When the young leader Manzoor Pashtun arrives, the crowd goes wild. Outspoken and fearless, he has become an unlikely leader. He openly criticizes the country's powerful military for what he claims are unconstitutional violations of their rights. The military has indicated it is not happy with the movement and its anti-military stance. It claims it has worked hard to try and clear the Pashtun areas from militants, but complete restoration takes time. Meanwhile, there are indications that media coverage of the movement is being censored.
Pakistan's local television channels that usually cover most protests live are conspicuous in their absence. Some say they've been directed by the country's powerful establishment to not cover the Pashtun Tahaffuz movement.
PTM intends to continue holding these protest rallies, including one in Pakistan's largest city, Karachi, in May. Aisha Tanzeem, VOA News, Lahore.
Getting an education seemed impossible for some displaced children in the mountainous Afghan province of Bamyan. They and their families live in caves that dot the cliffs around the city. Due to a lack of identity documents, they cannot attend school. But as VOA's Zafar Bamyani discovered, a classroom has come to them. Faith Lapidus narrates his report.
Centuries ago, these caves were places of worship for Buddhist monks. Today, they're homes for 200 poor Afghan families and one classroom. Farisht Ahmadi was able to stay in school after her family moved to the caves about a decade ago. She's now a senior at an all-girls high school in Bamyan. But she felt the need to educate the children of cave dwellers. So, 6 years ago, she converted her living space into a classroom. For 2 hours every day, she teaches 30 elementary school-age kids different subjects, including English. She says she wants to give an opportunity to the children who don't have access to mainstream schools.
Cave settlers are no different than people who live in modern communities or people who live in fancy apartments and buildings. They too can study, can go to public schools, and take private courses, so they enhance their abilities and development.
Using her own money, the young teacher opened a small library with 200 books to improve the reading skills of her students. She hopes to expand her cave class in the future.
In future, my plan is to convert my small course to a big school. And there must be some assistance from government and or other organizations so that I can take my services to the next level.
The children in this classroom are happy to get an education, and they have big dreams for the future.
We study different subjects here. For example, Dari, math, English, drawing, and reading. I want to become a doctor in the future and serve my people.
The reason why I study here is because I can't go to other courses. Our family's household income is really low, and we live in a cave.
Years of conflict and poverty forced these families to seek refuge in these ancient caves with no basic facilities and, prior to Ahmadi's initiative, no chance of getting an education for their children. After VOA's Afghan service broadcast a report about Ahmadi's school, Afghanistan's Ministry of Education offered to help her in her efforts. For Zafar Bamyani in Bamyan, Afghanistan, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Farmers in the American South are upgrading their cattle to the 21st century. With tech tools like AI or artificial intelligence and Wi-Fi, they are now able to monitor the herd and keep tabs on the animals that drive their business. Arash Arabasadi serves the high-tech beef.
To the untrained eye, these are just some cows hanging out in a pasture. But look closer. Those aren't bells around their necks.
It can pick up whether the cow is eating, whether it's ruminating, whether it's walking, whether it's drinking, whether it's laying down, standing up.
These farmers are using a new technology on their cows called Intelligent Dairy Farmer's Assistant, or IDA. It's a wearable device that helps them identify cows that are sick, less productive, or ready for breeding.
Our cows are outdoors 365 days of the year, and so there's not the human contact, if you like, with the cows on a continuous basis throughout the day.
Richard Watson monitors cows through a device created by Connectera that runs on a Google platform, feeding data into a network that recognizes patterns.
It's really exciting for us because we personally never would have thought to utilize this in the dairy industry, but
luckily, people like Connectera were able to use that open source machine learning framework. So
Watson says that improved communication with cattle is good for business.
Just a 10% or 5% increase or improvement in productivity means hundreds of thousands of dollars to us, aside from the fact that we just want happier, healthier, more welfare in our animals anyway.
Farmers say the technology makes industrial farming more efficient and keeps them better tuned in to the animals they use to feed much of the country as well as their families. Arash Arbasadi, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia Weekend from the Voice of America. Read, hear, and see more on these and other stories on our website at voanews.com and check out our Facebook page at VOA Asia. Please accept our invitation to join us next weekend. I'm Ira Melman in Washington, and we thank you for your time and your interest.